So he's going to talk to all of us about mindfulness meditation. We call it Vipassana meditation.
So, I'm talking
before we start meditation, it's good to understand a little bit about the nature of meditation. What is the work of meditation? What mindset should we practice meditation with? What attitude should we have when we're practicing meditation? We need to have this information with us first. Can everybody hear?
People in the back can't hear very well.
That's okay? This is better? So basically, the practice of meditation is what we do to improve the quality of our minds. The ordinary mind is not always, it's not always full of good quality stuff.
So, meditation,
so in meditation, we're trying to cultivate, develop, or grow the good qualities in the mind. So he wants to tell us that meditation is the work of the mind. Mind has to do the work, not the body. It's not the work of the body. So we're going to do this exercise. He's going to do a little demonstration. If you'll put your hands together the way you feel it, okay. Can you, do you know the sensation of the hands touching?
Yes.
Why do we know the sensation of the hands touching? The mind tells you that it's touching. Think So if the hands were touching but we were thinking of something else, we were lost in thought, would we recognize that the hands were touching?
Yes.
You're lost in thought. Would you be conscious of the fact that the hands were touching? No. So he's trying to say how the object that we pay attention to is not so important. It's, what's important is the mind. It has to be present. So the way the mind is working is important. Only when the mind pays attention, then it can clearly perceive a sensation. So, and also he says, when the mind meditates, it has to have the right attitude. He says, just because the mind focuses on something, still doesn't make it meditation yet. In the back of the mind that is meditating and paying attention, there has to be right information, right understanding about the nature of meditation and the right attitude.
wishing and wrong wishing.
So we can practice meditation in the right way or the wrong way.
We can have a wrong way of doing it. We can have a wrong way of doing it.တော့ဘာလို့ပါလို့ expectation ပါနေတယ်မချင်တဲ့တာတွေပါနေတယ်ဘာမှမကြည့်ဘူးဟိုလောဘတို့လာမောင်အထုံးကြီးပေါ့အဲ့ဒါဆိုတော့အထုံးလာမလို့
What he calls the wrong way of meditation is like this. He says if you have expectations when you're meditating, there's greed, or if you're dissatisfied with the practice, there's aversion, or you don't know how to meditate, there's delusion. If there's greed, aversion, or delusion in the mind, then you'd be practicing in the wrong way.So what we need to start meditation is right information. So he means that we need wisdom when we practice meditation. And in Buddhism, wisdom is enumerated into three levels of wisdom. The first is information. The second is intelligence, your own intelligence. The third is insight.So there's these three levels of wisdom.
Information, if
you come across some situation or something you have to do and you've never done this before, never come across it before, you won't know what to think of it and you won't know what to do about it. So before you do anything, he says, you need to have some theory on it, some information on it. Then you can do something practical about that,
right?
So he's going to give you as much information as he knows about meditation. So. There's two kinds of meditation that is possible to practice. There's what we call samatha, or tranquility meditation, and there is vipassana, or insight meditation. And we need to know the difference between these two kinds of meditation. The goal of samatha, or tranquility meditation, is jhana, deep concentration.The goal of vipassana or insight meditation is jnana, wisdom. So, first we have to know what we want. What do we want to get when we meditate? Those who want to grow or develop their wisdom will practice insight meditation. Those who want to develop concentration will practice samatha meditation.So here, his emphasis is on vipassana meditation. Many people want to practice vipassana meditation, but often the information that we have on meditation is information on samatha styles of meditation.So although it helps to calm the mind down, insight doesn't necessarily arise. So one of the things is that for samatha kinds of meditation, So when the goal of meditation is different, when the goals of the meditation are different, what happens is that the ideas behindthe meditation are different. The way the mind works is different. The practice becomes completely different. In samatha meditation, there is an emphasis on the object that you have to observe. In vipassana meditation, the emphasis is on the mind that is meditating. So you have to check, is there wisdom in the mind that's meditating, or is it greed, aversion, or delusion that's operating? In Vipassana, he says, because we're working towards wisdom, we have to use some intelligence. He says, sometimes, haven't you come across a situation where you just don't know what to do? What do you do when you don't know what to do with something? So if you had some information, you've heard something from somebody about this, he says, then you have the choice to apply that information to the situation. So we can use the information we have about something, use our own intelligence, and put these two together and apply ourselves to the situation. So likewise in meditation, he says, we've heard about awareness. He says, we think, okay, we'll be aware, he says, but we're not going to do it blindly. We're going to do it intelligently. What are we meditating for? Why are we being aware? What attitude are we having as we're practicing? All this has to be clear in our mind as we practice. This is what he calls pairing awareness with wisdom. That's why for Vipassana meditation, he says, the emphasis is on the mind, checking to see whether the mind is in the right state or not.
Right ideas in the mind, wrong ideas in the mind.
If we have the right idea in the mind, we'll practice in the right way. If we have the wrong idea, we could be practicing in the wrong way. And for samatha meditation, the mind needs to work on keeping its attention on one object only, and keeping the mind in that one place only. But vipassana meditation is concerned with all objects.
Why?
He says, because wisdom is the objective. When somebody wants to grow their wisdom or knowledge, he says they want a lot of information. They want to know everything possible. Whatever you're doing, you want to understand everything that's happening in there. That's why he says it's concerned, Vipassana meditation is concerned with all objects. He gives an example of a manager in a company, the boss. If he doesn't have all the information about what's happening below him, he won't be able to make correct decisions.
So
he says we need to be investigating and learning from everything there is. That's why we need to be open to investigate all experiences. And in samatha meditation, the mind tries to hold on to the object. It grasps onto the object energetically. So that requires a lot of energy. The mind has to use a lot of energy. The mind holds onto the object. There's a desire for permanence. But for Vipassana meditation, the mind is learning not to get attached to any object. It's learning to let go. So there's no energy needed. So the mind doesn't use energy to do anything to the object. It just needs a little wisdom to help it to let go. And because it's not interested in holding on to one object and, you know, targeting one thing that it needs to hold on to, he says then it has to be open and receive all objects, all experiences that pass through it.
ုကလက်မှာထိတဲ့ sensation တစ်ခုပဲယူမယ်ဆိုရင်ဒါပဲကြည့်မယ်ဆိုရင်အဲ့ဒါမှအများကြီး sensation နဲ့အများကြီးရှိတာနဲ့ရှိနေတာနဲ့တိဖို့မကြိုးစားတော့တစ်ခုကိုမဲနေလို့
For example he says if you know like our hands have been touching just now and we just try to pay attention to the sensation of touch he says there are actually many other sensations that are present in the hands touching butWhen we target one sensation or one experience that we want to observe, he says we don't even try to, and we don't notice what other experiences are possibly present. There might be hardness, softness, texture, all sorts of things, but because we're just paying attention to that one sensation that we think we're supposed to,Even though other things are present, we don't even try to notice if there's something else. So this quality of investigation, a sense of wanting to learn from what's happening, is lacking then, if we're targeting something that we want to observe. And in samatha meditation, there's a desire to create or achieve a particular result, a result that we're
hoping for.
So that requires energy. But for vipassana meditation, he says, we're trying to understand nature.And the way things are, and that's already there. He says you don't have to do anything. We're just trying to learn to recognize what's there as it is. So that doesn't require any effort to achieve any result. So the kind of practice you do and the kind of energy you put into the practice becomes very different for the two kinds of meditation. He says, so vipassana meditation is not tiring. He says, you can take it easy and practice. You just need to be interested. It's a relaxed way of practicing. He really never pushes the yogis. He doesn't make them tired. You don't get exhausted from the practice.So you can practice in comfort, but he will tell you to practice all the time. Don't stop. So you see, samatha meditation is a process of creating a particular result, but vipassana meditation is like a learning process. He says,You're not trying to make things different. You're just taking things as they are and trying to learn from what is happening as it is. You're just acknowledging this is happening. For example, in samatha meditation, if the mind is not calm, you're going to calm the mind down. If it's feeling distracted, you're going to collect the mind. But for vipassana meditation, if the mind is not calm, you're not going to try to calm it down. You just want to acknowledge that this is the way the mind is feeling now and investigate what that is like. So in vipassana in samatha meditation, there is this focusing, the use of energy to focus the mind onto one object. In samatha meditation, there's not this focusing. There's just a sort of settling back and waiting and watching to see what is happening. So he says,We have to reflect on our own practice and, you know, understanding these differences between samatha and vipassana, see what we are doing in our own practice. And then he will give you a little definition of the five faculties. Does everybody know the five faculties?
No.
No. So there's five faculties that we say five qualities of mind that are working together when we meditate. And they are what we call awareness, sati in Pali, samadhi, which is often translated as concentration. Then there's virya, often translated as right effort. And then there is saddha, which is often translated as faith or confidence. And the last one is panya, wisdom. So there's these five qualities that are working together when we meditate. And he's going to define, redefine for you these five qualities.
The five qualities are in meditation.
In meditation, we are using these five qualities of mind. When we use these five qualities, we call it meditation. And as we meditate, what we're doing is we're giving time to these qualities of mind to be manifesting in the mind as long as possible. So they grow, we're growing these qualities.
Awareness, outside of awareness and mindfulness of your outside the routine, focus on the routine, awareness and deepening.
So the first faculty he's redefining is awareness. We're often given to understand awareness as focusing onto an object. But he says the Pali word sati, which we do usually call awareness, is just a not forgetting. It's not a focusing on something, it's a not forgetting. And what you're not forgetting is not forgetting what's happening in your own mind and your own body. And to not forget or to be remembering or conscious of yourself, your own body and mind, he says, doesn't require any energy. If you even think of yourself, like you remember yourself, well, what am I doing now? He says, immediately awareness becomes present. What's happening to me now? What's happening in the mind? And once this sort of awareness is there, you're conscious, you've become conscious. He says, all you want to do is continue being conscious. You want to remain conscious in that way. And the second faculty, which we often call concentration, he would redefine samadhi as just stability of mind, just a stable mind. If the mind feels peaceful or relaxed, just doesn't seem to be moving very much, you can say the mind has samadhi. So he's saying for vipassana meditation, you don't need a lot of concentration, just stability. There's two kinds of samadhi that we can develop. One is from the samatha kind of practice where you focus on one object continuously and the mind quiets down. That sort of concentration is a bit heavy. There's kind of, yeah, heaviness, rigidity in it. But if that kind of focusing is too much, you get too absorbed in what you're focused on, he says then the mind isn't so alert anymore, then intelligence doesn't work, so it's not so agile anymore. And if there's too much, he said, you can even start becoming a zombie. Like a zombie. Too much focusing. But when you practice vipassana, he says, then wisdom is at work. It's either information or intelligence or insight. So you have some information or your own powers of reasoning or some insight or understanding that helps you to understand what's happening in a reasonable way. Then he says the mind just doesn't react. And why it doesn't react is because there's not as much greed or aversion, not as much expectation, disappointment, and so on. And then the mind feels stable. It feels okay with it. And that's vipassana kind of samadhi. He says from that sort of samadhi, insight can arise.
The mind is just a body, but the data will arise from the mind.
And in those kinds of samadhi states, you'll find that the mind feels light, agile. And the mind is able to, like, know many things because it's alert and agile.
Unless it's awake.
It's awake. And then the faculty of right effort. He says effort is again another way we usually understand effort, like we're putting in energy, you know, like we use our bodies to do something. He says effort is a mental effort, and even then not much mental effort. It's more a quality of patience and perseverance. When you understand that something is worth doing, it's been beneficial for you, and you want to do it over a long term, over the long term, he says you persevere in doing that. He says, and since you're going to be doing this long term, for always, he says, if you use too much energy in one sitting or one retreat, he says, you can't carry on doing this for always, all your life. But for Vipassana meditation, this doing it always is very important. Continuity of awareness is very important. But if we focus too much, use too much energy, then we can't keep doing it over a long period of time. So it's like running a marathon where you conserve energy, not like doing a 100-meter dash. And when we talk about the qualities of faith or confidence, we're talking about confidence and faith in ourselves and the work, the practice that you're doing. What is the benefit of the practice for yourself? It's only when you understand the benefit of the practice for yourself that you feel faith or confidence in the practice. When we say that meditation, there is progress in meditation, he says it's really about checking to see whether these qualities are stronger in the mind. And the last of the five faculties is wisdom. And the kinds of wisdom we're talking about, he says, you might have heard of Vipassana insights and enlightenment and all. He said he's not talking about all that. He's talking about very simple kinds of wisdom. He says even understanding how to practice in the correct way and become skillful at your own practice, that's a kind of wisdom. If we don't have the skillfulness, the wisdom of understanding how to practice in the right way, he says the other kinds of insight aren't going to come. Deeper understandings can't come if you're not practicing correctly, if you're not understanding
correctly.
Because when we're not skillful at doing a practice, he says then we can't maintain the practice and then we can't improve on the practice. He says, so when we talk about practice, the practice of meditation, he says, which is meditating, the body or the mind? The mind. He says, but we use this mind to practice meditation, but we are not conscious of how this mind is working. We don't know how much energy it's using, we don't know what ideas the mind is holding, we don't know what attitude the mind is practicing with. He says, do you think that we can become skillful at the practice? He says we find sometimes that we have a good sitting, sometimes we have a bad sitting, bad you know, practice, good practice, but that depends on our states of mind, how the mind has been working. But if we don't recognize how our mind has been working that has resulted in this good or bad sitting or whatever, he says, then we won't learn how to fine-tune it to become skillful at doing practice. So he'd like to suggest that when we practice meditation, don't just be interested in the things that you're observing. He said, come back to checking the mind that is doing the observing. How is that mind? Is it feeling tense, relaxed? Does it have the right attitude? Does it have some wrong attitude?
Yes,
so it's a checking. So the practice has to be a checking of the mind constantly and practicing together with
them.
Instead of just focusing on the object all the time. And then there's three important points that he wants to get to. The first one is that continuity of awareness is very important for vipassana practice. Because momentum is very important. When you do something all the time, continuously, it gains momentum. If you do something just for a short period of time, use a lot of energy to do it in that short period of time, it doesn't really become a very strong practice. You can't maintain that kind of power all the time. So he says he encourages people to just practice as much as possible. Not use too much energy to focus and all that. Just being as conscious as possible, but to do that without stopping, continuously. Because vipassana is a learning process, he says, it's not something that you can do for a short term. Like, it's not over. The work is not over. If you really want to understand vipassana, and it's a learning process, you've got to do it for over a long period of time before you really understand it. For in any field of study or work, he says, it's only when you've been doing it for a long time and you've been close to that work or field of study for a long time that you start to understand more and more about that subject. That's why he says continuity is so important. He says that brings a natural energy when we do it continuously. If you think of a haystack on fire, you know, it's like the personal energy we put into practice. He says there's a huge fire and then it's gone in a quick hurry. But he says natural energy is like coal fire, you know, like an ember. It burns and burns slowly over a long period of time, and that's a natural energy. And the other thing that continuity brings is that you become able to notice whole processes. You see things happen from the beginning through the middle to the end, and then understanding can arise about this. So he doesn't think that there is any particular time for practice. He thinks all time is time for practice, all the time. It's just not forgetting to watch yourself. The posture doesn't really matter. Whether you're walking or sitting or standing, whatever. Eating, showering, changing your clothes. whatever posture you're in, he says, what's important is, are these five qualities of mind working? Awareness and so on. He says, so you can practice in any posture. Choose something that's comfortable for you. Don't practice in a way that makes you feel tired and stressed. Another thing is, he wants to give you an example of how you can be aware without focusing. How to practice without using energy, like he says. He says, do we know why we use so much energy when we do things? Trying too hard, somebody said. Because we want something. So when we want something, we use a lot of energy to try and get it. And when we're unhappy with something, we use a lot of energy to be away from it.
Dissatisfaction.
Yeah. And if we don't know what's going on, we also use a lot of energy to try to. But actually, he says we don't need to use so much energy. All we need to use is wise thinking, intelligence. So we need information on what to do. So he'll give you a demonstration of not using energy. Okay, so he says, just become conscious of yourself. Don't put your attention on the nostrils or the rising falling. Just become conscious of the whole body. Do you notice the hands touching? Yes, you're touching the floor. The sitting posture.
Sound.
The temperature. So you notice all that. Does it require much energy to notice that? So that's all the energy you need. Is that hard? Is that difficult? Is it tiring? Can you stay like that all day? In any posture. It's not tiring.
I love energy.
The mind just needs to put out just that little amount of energy. But you need to be interested. What's happening in the body? How's the mind feeling? What's it thinking? What is the relationship between thinking, feeling, body sensations? You need to be interested.
Anytime,
any posture. As you move through postures. And then you don't need to be at a retreat center. You can do it at home.
Office, hallelujah.
Or in the office. If you focus into something too much, if you focus on one sensation too much, then you can't do this kind of thing. Everybody, all of us actually know ourselves a little bit. You just need to become more interested in knowing yourself. So that's why we meditate, because we want to understand ourselves better. Why are we being aware? Because we want to understand the nature of the body and the mind as it is. He said, consider these two kinds of people. One of these persons, he doesn't know what he's doing. doesn't know what he's feeling, doesn't know what he's thinking, but he's doing what he's doing. The other person is doing the same thing, but he's conscious of what he's doing. He's conscious of what he's feeling as he's doing it. He's also conscious of his thoughts as he's doing this. He says, what do you think is the difference in the quality of these two persons? When the quality of mind is different, then the quality of life becomes very different. If you compare these two people, one of these persons has quite a meaningless life, and the other one has a more meaningful life. So he says it's really not difficult to know yourself, to be conscious. You just need to be interested in it, to be conscious. If you really begin to understand the mind, he says, you really start to understand how to keep it happy. Because when you understand how the mind works, the nature of the mind, he says, then you know how to, you won't just let it be unhappy because you know how it works. You can keep it happy. And so you learned how to not keep yourself unhappy, learn how to become happy. It's because we usually don't understand our minds that we stress the mind out. But if we understand something, he says, then we have to constantly be checking it out, investigating it, studying it. The easiest thing to notice about ourselves is our body sensations. But when you've been noticing the sensations of your body for a long time, he says you'll also start to begin to notice the states of your mind that accompany these body sensations. How is the mind feeling when things are happening in the body, or vice versa? And if you notice the way, the states of mind the mind is in, you will also begin to notice the attitudes that are lying behind that state of mind and why the mind is in that state. So that's waiting and watching yourself, waiting on yourself and watching yourself. And the last point is right view. And he feels that this is the most important thing in Vipassana meditation. So he says, we're noticing ourselves, we're watching ourselves, we're noticing all these experiences or objects. And what point of view do we see these objects from? From what point of view do we view our experiences? He says we have sensations in our body, yeah? You're familiar, like we feel heat, cold, texture, hardness, softness, movement, all these things. Movement. Are we the only, am I the only one who experiences this? Everybody can experience these sensations. What about feelings?
Pleasant,
unpleasant, neutral feelings. Are you the only person who feels it? No. What about the mind? Thinking mind, good quality minds, anger, whatever. Are you the only person who experiences these?
No.
So then, it's obvious that these qualities are universal. These are universal qualities. This is very important to realize. So you have to see these qualities as nature, a quality of nature. So it's impersonal. It's not yours. Have you been angry before?
And did
you have this thought, I'm angry? I am angry. And when you think I am angry, does that make you more angry or less angry?
More angry.
More angry. Everybody's experienced this. Why? Do you know why it makes you more angry when you think I am angry? Judging yourself. He says it's because fundamentally it's a wrong thought. It's a wrong view to think I am angry. Because he said anger is a universal quality, it's nature, not I. So there is anger.
I never talk to any emotion. I never identify learning is
so there's all this nature that's happening. He says, and when we identify the nature with me, I am this nature, he says, then it increases, it grows. He says that's why people who are depressed get more and more depressed.
I am depressed.
They think I am
depressed. Depression, angry,
he says these qualities, depression, sadness, anger, they're just mind qualities. Mind, M-I-N-D, qualities. So if you're going to investigate this experience of some emotion, he says, firstly, we must not let the automatic identification with the experience come in. So you have to remind yourself of this right view. So just in the beginning, intellectually, you're going to remind yourself of this right view. This is nature, not my anger. And then you're going to observe that anger. Then it will be right awareness.
Identify the wrong awareness.
He says the moment we identify with the experience, then even if we pay attention to it, it's going to be wrong awareness. Then although we might be practicing by watching continuously, insight doesn't arise. We don't understand anything more. So he says it's not that we aren't aware of anger. All of us are aware we're angry when we're angry, but it's because we think I am angry that we can be with it, but we just get more and more angry. He says, so we're not angry because we want to be angry, we're angry because we're unintentionally feeding the anger with wrong view. But if we can bring this wisdom to bear on the experience and use awareness together with it, he said, when we work on this together like this, he says, then slowly, he says, we can work down these emotions. Then the emotion can't overwhelm you anymore. So the emotion can arise. It's not that the emotions won't come, but if we use this right information we have, the wisdom that, you know, this information we have, and we use awareness and work with it together, he says, then all these emotions won't get out of control anymore. And if we do it every time we have an emotion, he says, then we won't get to the point that we're suffering from the emotion anymore. And then as we become conscious of these emotions, yeah, the more often we become conscious of these emotions, he says, we get to the point where we start to understand why these emotions are coming. And when we understand why it's happening, we even have the choice to prevent it from happening anymore. But he says, really, the point of meditation like this is it's not to make these things go away. The point is not to make these emotions go the experience go away. It's not to have the experience either. The point is really to investigate what's there, to understand what the experience is. He says, so if somebody understands now that everything that the person experiences in the body or the mind is just nature, everything is just nature, what we experience is nature, then he said, does anything become a disturbance anymore to us? Is sound a disturbance anymore? Is noise disturbing anymore then?
Wandering mind.
Is wandering mind a disturbance anymore? If it's just nature?
Problem over.
It's not a problem anymore. The mind is doing what it's doing. You just do what you have to do. Very basically, that's all of it. So it's the same whether you sit or walk or eat or talk.
Oh,
one more thing, important pain. Dealing with
pain.
So we do sitting meditations and we often have pain. What do you do when you have pain? Sorry?
Complain.
Is this you meditate to complain?
No.
So, his advice to yogis when they come across pain in their meditation is not to watch pain directly. Not to watch it.
It's not important.
It's not important to. What is important is that this is an opportunity to explore the relationship between the mind and the body. This is in our lives at home. We are always having sensory contacts through our sense doors. And with every contact of our sense doors, what the mind does is react with liking or disliking that experience. This is so natural for the mind to react to every contact.
Unpleasant feeling, loving, experience, loving, immediately.
So the moment you have an unpleasant experience like pain, the mind immediately reacts with disliking.
And if you experience loving.
And if you have a pleasant experience, the mind reacts with liking.
Attachment.
You want to have this for a long time. This is the nature of the mind. So if someone spends time just watching the object, he says what will happen naturally is the mind will just keep reacting to the object with liking or disliking. But if we keep observing the object with a reacting mind, he says, then it will be wrong awareness. It's not wisdom watching, it's That's why he says he's not so concerned with observing the object. He's really concerned with checking the mind. So when there is pain, he says, how should we view pain? What is pain? Whose pain is it?
My pain will all be there.
If we think it's my pain, we're going to stop shouting, is it?
Wrong view.
So you see how wrong view comes in so easily. So whatever experience you have, the mind will automatically identify with it. That's why he wants people to remember to inject this right view into the practice before being aware. So you have to think before you practice. Being aware or mindful comes later, he says. It's not so important. The right view must come in first. That's important.
ကြုံနေတဲ့ experience မဟုတ်ဘူးဘယ်လိုစဉ်းစား right view နဲ့စဉ်းစားပြီးမှအားထုတ်ပ
ါ So you have to check you having an experience what's your view for it and after you sorted out your view then start being mindful
and learning process can happen
then a learning process can happen a learning
find လာပြီဆိုတော့ involve ဖြစ်မယ်ခံစားမယ်ပေါ့
He says, if we're identified with the experience, what we'll do is we'll get involved, we'll start feeling into the thing, we'll start suffering, and we'll start complaining. So when you have pain, he said, check. What is the mind thinking? How is the mind feeling? Check that first. From what point of view is the mind viewing this experience of pain? So you can recall all the things that he said, go through them, and adjust your attitude first. There's pain. When there's pain, there'll be aversion. This is the nature of the mind. So you're going to pay attention to the aversion. That's what's important. The pain is not important. When that state of mind, the aversion, if it shifts, you know, and the mind gets into a better mood, he says, then you can investigate the nature of pain. So there's the object and the mind that's observing it.
စိတ်ထဲမှာလောဘဒေါသဖြစ်နေတယ်ဒီသူကလောဘဒေါသနဲ့ကြည့်နေအာယုံတရားအယုံသူကလောဘရဲ့အာယုံဒေါသရဲ့အာယုံဖြစ
် But in the mind that's observing he said if there is greed in the mind that's observing or there's aversion in the mind that's observing then that object is going to just be an object of greed or of greed's view or aversion
as it is malana
view it's not going to be an object seen as it is not neutral It's like having colored glasses on.
Red color, tie.
If you put on red glasses, you see everything red.
Blue color, tie.
If you put on blue glasses, everything is blue.
So, see the glasses are easy.
So the glasses you put on are very important.
Sick are easy.
Which means the state of mind of the mind that you is observing is very important.
Sick are right movement, right idea, see my eye on. Right, I do it. As it is, we get the problem.
Only when the mind is in the right mood and it has the right idea, then what it sees will be right as it is. Anybody have any questions?
About this.
About what he said?
So what color glasses are we supposed to wear?
Right attitude, that information in color and get sense of it.
The glasses of right attitude.
Right information, right attitude.
So you have to think about what is right information, right attitude. Think over what he said. He says information is very important. That's why he tries to say so much. But we still need to learn a lot from ourselves, for ourselves. And you have to read and you have to practice, and from the practice you have to ask, discuss. Yeah. If somebody knows, ask them, and there has to be an interaction growing. Once you have some information, you must try to apply that information to practice. He says, first you have to recognize whether your glasses are red or blue. He says, if you recognize you're wearing red glasses, take them off first. He says he's sure you will know how to do this. You will know how to use this information.
Diga, atho the signal, expedition in Myanmar. I'm losing my yard, I'm missing pin. I'm missing it. I'm missing when I'm teaching a session in that.
One thing to really watch out for is he says, as you practice, do you have a lot of expectations of the practice or yourself? Or are you, do you have a lot of dissatisfaction with yourself or the practice? And you need to notice that.
He says,
but if you have just a desire to understand what's happening, you want to investigate, you want to learn from what's happening, that's good enough. He says, that's using your intelligence. Yes?
You mentioned not using too much energy in the practice of meditation, but what if the itch becomes pain, and the pain and resisting, scratching the itch to take the pain away, becomes a focus of great energy? At that point, your mindfulness, your awareness, and the desire to not have too much energy in this, don't conflict them.
He says, don't wait until it gets that bad. Scratch it. He says, why are you trying to prevent something from happening? The right attitude is to try to learn from the situation as much as you can, but if it's getting so difficult, then there's no need to put yourself into that corner. Get out of it. He says the basic objective of meditation, to improve the good qualities of mind. So you shouldn't be allowing the negative qualities of mind to be growing, like resistance and aversion and so on. Don't allow that to grow. He says, so when we sit meditation, should we move or should we not move? He says, if you should move, you should move. If you should not move, you should not move. So you need to use your wisdom. Not a fixed thing. It's a learning process, so there's no rigidity around it. You do as much as you can, and if you can't take it, do what's comfortable for that moment. The Buddha called it the middle way. He says if the reason we move is because of greed, like we just can't stand it, we just need to move all the time, so you just keep moving all the time, so you're feeding your greed, that's wrong too, that's one extreme. But the other extreme is not moving at all, like you're just like forcing yourself to sit with it. But if there's an element of forcing, that's the other extreme. So we're going to use wisdom. We've got to use our wisdom. And we're going to investigate what is happening in the moment as it is for as long as we can. And then, if we can't take it anymore, we're going to back off for now. There will always be a chance to investigate again. And if we investigate rightly each time and every time, we start learning more about this. We start also learning how to handle it. Then you'll find that you can do it for a little longer and a little longer each time because you're learning something. We're not skillful immediately yet. Yes?
Sounds to me like you're saying that there is not much place for samatha meditation, and I'm wondering, as a person whose mind tends to wander sometimes so far that I lose track of time and it takes forever to come back to mindfulness, would it not make sense to try to develop a certain amount of expertise in that kind of concentrated object meditation first, before moving into a vipassana practice?
Well, I think you're on the Dhammata, who don't go near my sheet a little better, and I'm a two of you, Charadwa, nine and she, two to him, a myomini nine, and at the deep and yahoo, or on a pin, I used to know, and I will do, ready to move the Matano, your bones, and I don't hear my name, or say, good, Jansi, I'm not cool, look at the woman.
He says it's better if you just open your eyes and sit meditation. Don't close your eyes and stay lost in thought.
He says when our eyes are shut, it's very difficult to take the mind out of its habitual pattern of what it does when the eyes are closed. And actually, he says, you know, so with your eyes open, if you're aware of many things instead of just one thing, he says it's also difficult for the mind to sort of get sucked into something easily because it has to sort of stay on top of the game, like, I'm aware of this. What's the next thing I'm aware of? If you do close your eyes and meditate, he says, and if you can notice, like even 5 minutes into thinking of something, and you know you're in danger of getting lost in thought, he said, stop immediately then and just close your, just open your eyes. Just physically open your eyes. And then you're back in the present moment immediately. He says, because seeing, sight, is a very strong object. Clear. So you won't be lost in thought anymore. You'll be back in the present.
Is there any place at all for samatha then?
He says, you know, we do start by observing objects, right? Whatever we're observing, we're paying attention. And there is some element of samatha in that already. But he says what we're doing now is we're not allowing the mind to just stay with the objects all the time. Every now and again, we're going to check the mind to see whether it is and doing it in the right state of mind, doing it with the right attitude. He says, and if somebody has already had a practice of doing samatha, they find it easy, like to do some self-practice to calm the mind down for the first few minutes and all, that's fine. You can use that before switching over and doing it more open.
I mean, to beginner, you see, samatha or chin, but being like, logo, chin, miyan, in the loop, right attitude, information, below, chin, inclusive, many, many.
But he says there are beginners, you know, they've never practiced meditation before, and if you just give them like a samatha style of practice, it takes them too long to calm their mind down by staying on one object. If you just give them the right information and they have the right attitude to the practice, then having the right attitude just calms their mind down. They don't feel anxious about things anymore, and that gives them the stability instantly. He says one of the things is that many people think wandering mind is a hindrance to the practice. But for Vipassana practitioners, he says, really to understand that it's not a problem, then that's the right attitude. Wandering mind is a function of the mind. It's one of the things the mind does, and you want to recognize this is the nature of the mind at work. Our responsibility is only to recognize this is the mind at work. Not to complain about it. He says, I mean, to be reasonable, we spend our whole lives thinking about things we need to do, and then we come into a meditation and we think the mind should settle down. That's not reasonable. The mind has its momentum. He says, how can you stop a speeding car by just hitting the brakes? He's just screeching and smoke and all that. So the yogi brain will start overheating.
Is there ever a time though, once you practice this a long time, that you do come to a place where the brakes at work?
The brakes work. After that time, in the same time, a break dia,
alone.
He says, when you've been practicing a long time, you don't need the brakes anymore. It's automatic.
I wonder if one of the strong reactions I have in emotional is fear and anxiety, which has power. I wonder if you could speak about that. It's the same thing of just saying, oh, not mine, or something.
Yes, but I do instead of right view
intent. First, he says yes, inject that idea in. But if you find the fear and the anxiety as too strong, like it's overwhelming, he says don't keep watching that emotion continuously. He says alternate. Watch that in some neutral object, something neutral, and then come back to it a little and go back there. So one anchors your mind, the other keeps it in view. And one exercise he's going to give you. He says for people who have a lot of emotion, he suggests four questions that you can ask yourself when you're going through the emotion. It will be easy to remember. It's intuitive.
Yeah.
So first you have that right attitude, you tell yourself, this is nature, and then you ask yourself, so when this emotion arises, does it make the body and the mind feel pleasant or unpleasant? So there's a need to recognize every time it arises, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. If the mind recognizes the unpleasantness of it every time it arises, very naturally, the natural mind doesn't want to experience this so much anymore. Then that mind is going to find its own way out of it. So it will learn to meditate more. The second question is, what is the emotion about? And in this question, he says the answers include things that are happening in the body and things that are happening in the mind, your thoughts and the feelings. Our thoughts and our feelings, our emotions are very closely connected. Sometimes you will notice a negative thought immediately generates a negative feeling, an unpleasant feeling. Sometimes we come through difficult situations in our life, and you'll notice if you have an unreasonable thought about it, that it just makes you feel worse about the situation. But if you have some right thought about it, some reasonable thought, you'll find the mind settles down. Okay, and so the third question is of why this is happening, and he makes this distinction between the second question and the third question. The basic difference is one of the questions is about what you're experiencing, the thoughts and the emotions. The other thing is, what is the external story about? What is the story?
Is that three?
Yeah.
Three, yes.
What is the what about?
Sorry?
What did you just say? What is the something about?
External, like one is what are you feeling this emotion about? The other is why are you feeling this emotion? And in English, the distinction is not so clear. But basically, the distinction he wants to make out is
one,
whether it's the
like,
mind or the feeling, and the next one is what's happening.
Yeah, one is
weird.
What is the emotion like? Like, what are the thoughts like? What are the feelings like? And the other one is
what's the story?
Yeah.
The content,
yeah. And the last question is it necessary to feel this emotion? He says, if we ask ourselves this question, we always, intellectually, we know it's a no. There's no need to, there's no necessity. But the mind deeply does not understand it enough and therefore is not able to let go. So there's a need to investigate it every time. He says when the mind really understands, he says the emotion will really go down. Yeah. And if the understanding is really very strong, he says then that sort of emotion won't even have the power to come in anymore. So be interested in the emotion, he said.
I don't identify with it.
But don't identify with it. Don't think it's yours. Somebody want to? Yeah, you had a question?
I have a question. I feel like I was taught Vipassana meditation as what you're calling just concentrating your mind as opposed to Vipassana. And I'm wondering if he has encountered this a lot, because this is very different from what I was taught, which was like, you know, concentrate on my breath and keep bringing my mind back to it.
That's right. So what? He says it is a beginning exercise for Vipassana meditation. You start with samatha, you know, sort of thing. Yeah. He's come across this a lot. But instead of using the word concentrate, he likes to use the word recognize. Because the energy becomes very different. And then he also tells yogis that they don't need to have this feeling that they have to stay on that object. It's not a have to. Not all the time. Yeah, they have to. He explains the need for the object is just to teach the mind what awareness is. It's just a tool. I'll just go for
it. Hi. I just first want to say how wonderful it is to be here. I was in Burma several years ago, and it just knowing that you were from Burma just really drew me here today. Thank you. I wanted to come back to the busy mind. And I'm wondering if one way to work with that mentioned earlier is asking, you know, what am I thinking? So can that be a tool to sort of come back and refocus, so to speak?
Yes, you can use that thought, that question. He says what questions help to do is bring interest into the mind, to just look at it objectively. Yes. So that's fine.
So when you are working with aversion, like, do you treat it in the same way as a visiting entity, like, don't identify and then try to examine it in the an objective way? I mean, when he says to identify the aversion and then get the right attitude, what is that?
Yeah. Tuha, mire, aro doda ne, lo lo ne, doda ne wa lo da kama. Adiga, tu shi ane identify mo lo ne, ne fa ro tu objective bichi da. Uzi ya tu nature lo de bota ro lo da ena pyo ra, mo ipa lo pyo ra.
Yes, you're exactly saying what he means. He says, you know, when we have any right attitude, like reminding ourselves that this is nature, or any other, like you say, to look at it objectively or whatever, if we're actually able to bring in the right attitude, immediately it disengages us from the experience. So he says that's the nature of wisdom at work. That's the quality of wisdom. Whenever wisdom is there, he says, what wisdom does is it steps away and it surveys the scene. When there's a defilement at work, he says, it just gets involved. It gets right into it. And when defilements get involved, then they just feed it.
But also, along that point, the defilements can also masquerade as wisdom, because sometimes I have the experience of recognizing that there's aversion, but and bringing the right thought of it's not nature, it's this is just nature. But behind that thought of this is just nature is still the defilement of wanting to
get rid of it,
kind of separate from it a little bit.
He says, so don't believe every thought. Check. He says, the checking has to be constant. Constant. You just can't believe in anything all the time. He says, the defilements are very smart. Very smart. They come with all sorts of masks, faces.
I have the same sort of question. It's after a moment of observing correctly or disengaging with an emotion, there is a certain pleasure experienced in that recognition.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is that yet another defilement, or is that a wholesome state that's like, sort of okay to experience because it's wholesome?
You have to recognize that's happening. Don't rest on your laurels. He's just said to you, the demons are very smart.
But one of the questions, I mean, I think when the last question of is this necessary?
Yeah.
But I think that sometimes, unless you have a feeling that something can be achieved, that you need some kind of, I don't know, incentive to keep going on. That there are some necessary thoughts, some belief that eventually all these thoughts will cease, or that they will, that you'll understand them, and that you will put all these unwanted and unnecessary parts of the mind will cease, or that you'll become at peace with them. Because we don't feel that somewhere will happen, if there's no thought that something good will happen, it's hard to continue.
Sorry, the necessary or not is about the defilements. And my understanding that you're saying is it necessary or not, it seems
well,
to be...
Well, isn't just, I mean, is it, well, I guess what I misunderstood it, because to me I thought it was about all thoughts. Is this thought necessary?
Okay, we were talking about emotions just now.
But it only goes to defilements, not to all thoughts.
Okay, that's...
She was switching back to an earlier string of...
I know what she was saying, but we were talking about emotions there, but she's talking about something completely different. She's talking about, well, it's not so different, but about thoughts.
Emotion is shoot.
So he's explaining again why he used that question, is it necessary or not? And he says in having, when we have an emotion or any experience and we want to investigate, the use of the questions is to bring interest to observing what's happening. And that's why we're using the question. So then he has a series of questions, and the last one is it necessary or not? But it's just to bring interest to that, to not be so involved in it. He said, and you know, if we really understand that something is necessary or unnecessary, he said that's really the highest kind of understanding of all the others. You know, in the others there's some understanding of cause and effect, process and stuff like that. This is really an understanding when the mind understands fundamentally there's no benefit in this, or fundamentally there's no use in it or something, and then the mind is able to let it go because it sees it's not necessary. But the question is to bring in interest. And he wants to come back to that question. You were talking about, so there's some feeling of pleasantness about having been able to disengage, right? He says, and if you don't watch that pleasant feeling because you think, you know, the mind is, it has become able to do something, he says, you know what happens next? He said, you set up an expectation that you'll always be able to do it. And once you start watching your emotions to be able to do the same thing again, you'll find you're not able to do it anymore. He's come across a man. He had a, you know, in his first meditation retreat, a great experience. You know, he worked through something and he thought it was great, and he thought that's what meditation was about. And then every retreat ever since, he just kept trying to recreate that experience, and he went on doing that for 20 years. And he never got it again. Because he never talked to anyone about it, he didn't have anyone to, you know, sort of bounce it off, and he just kept practicing with that expectation in mind. So you see how important information is. 20 years.
So I guess to piggyback on that comment of going over expectations and trying to recreate experiences, isn't part of meditation developing certain pathways in your mind that you can then move back and do the same things with your mind so that you can get to a place of more insight? That, so you're not simply stuck again and again in the thought or stuck in delusion, that part of the growth that happens is that you start to recognize, okay, if I do this, I can start to become more calm. If I do this, I can start to gain more insight. So on the one hand, going in with an expectation can be a bad thing, but also going in with trying to figure out a way to get to a certain experience can also can be part of the practice.
I'm understanding what you're saying. ตาก็อะไรสิกกูมันก็ไม่อัจฉริยะติดๆมวยไปน่ะไม่เข้าหูล่ะไอ้ปกมากูอ่ะอแงดีบ่ผิดอีกทีเราดีโหสึกกับเรียกชื่อมาได้มั้ยกูอ่ะอัธุไปสิกกูสึกก็ไม่ผิดหรอกกูโดนอะไรไปไหนโดนอะไรไม่ผิดหรอกสึกกูอลบอย่างมากไอ้พวกนี้ดีโดนลงมาแล้วกูอ่ะสึกกูอัจฉริยะติดๆไปน่ะด่าเนี่ยกูว่าเรา
expectations.
He says, you know, the basic thing is that what you're talking about, he doesn't call expectation, he calls that an objective. You know this works, this is beneficial, therefore you're working towards it.
but not with an expectation that it must happen. But you're working towards it.
Expectation by the second one. Rudy Amazon. Expectation by the
second. He says, how do you recognize if there's an expectation? He says, you'll notice if you're expecting it to happen, your mind starts to have tension, anxiety, because it, yeah, it's not relaxed anymore. It's not just learning. Yeah, it's not in balance anymore.
Can you talk more about defilements, how to recognize them, define them?
Defilement for Bulolobra, recognize Luamlan. This is the most obvious way is to check your feelings. If it's a defilement, it makes you suffer.
So it can be, so it's related to feelings, to states of mind.
Yes.
Yeah, so pay more attention to that. Be more in touch with
it.
He says sometimes your mind will say something seemingly altruistic, but if you check your feelings, it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know something is going on.
I guess I don't know what the defilements are.
Oh.
Yeah. Just bad quality minds, like dishonesty. I mean, basically, we call it greed, aversion, and delusion. Very basically. If you expand on it, there's just so many kinds of offshoots.
Jealousy,
envy, dishonesty, aggression, depression,
disliking,
sadness.
All emotions.
Most emotions. Agitating emotions, yeah. Yes.
If this process helps us know who we are, and if after time we do indeed know who we are, and if we don't like what we know, is it really possible to skillfully affect the changes that we envision?
Okay. He says it will be helpful if you look at it from this point of view. He says we've gone through life thinking we're good, and then now we look at it and we see that it's actually not all good. There is stuff in there that needs working on. He says it motivates us to start working on it, but only if you don't identify with it. If you don't think that this is me, then you're free to work with it. A lot of people ask this question. A lot of people say, when I start looking at my mind, all I see is... Yeah. Not nice stuff.
So in a sense, it's right to be judgmental.
This is not judgmental. Yeah, judgmental, he says, comes from a point of view of like an opinion. It's not something you know. Now you're looking at yourself. You know what's there, but it is there. It's not you. It's just a quality of mind. He says it's very different to have an opinion of what's there and to really see what's there.
If you feel what's there is a part of your nature.
Not your nature. This is my problem.
He says, this is the problem. Fundamentally, although we use the words me, my, you, your, and all that, he says, but fundamentally what we are trying to recognize is the nature at work, the mind. The mind, He says there's a nature, there's a cause and effect relationship in everything. If the mind behaves in this way, this is the result. If it behaves in another way, that's the result. And you're trying to understand this, how the mind creates results for itself all the time. And if you understand the causes, then you take away some of the causes, then some of the effects don't come anymore.
So it sounds like right view in this context is what is sometimes referred to as non-duality or egolessness, things like that in some
traditions.
Maybe like in like Mahayana tradition,
yeah.
The idea of right jumping view. In a way past our own storyline and identification to sort of a more open view.
Okay.
Unattachment to the ego. And
what's the question?
I guess the question, well, I'm wondering if you can comment on that, because there seems to be like a certain confidence that is necessary to make that jump.
Yeah.
And I've heard that just terminology used a lot of, you know, egolessness.
Yeah. We make this the last question. I'm sorry. Yeah.
ตัวเกี่ยวกับดีไรฟ์วิวอะไรดิฉันมาน้ำบารมีว่าผมน้อมอยู่อะไรจริงๆคู่แกรนด์ของผมอีโกเลสนะส่วนแล้วก็ที่ช่วงหาเรื่องปลุกเกี่ยวกับเรื่องที่น้ำมาหุบได้หาเรื่องคงไม่น้ำพอแล้วก็ตีน้ำไปตัวบารมีทำได้ลุ้นเดียวกว่าเรื่องคู่หาคู่ตัวนี้ความเป็นชีวิตดีน้ำชีเราเงินใช้เงี้ยมาพอแล้วหลวงพ่อมาห่วยแดนดีไรฟ์วิวเป็นไงตัวเกี่ยวกับลิขิตมีอะไรช่วยช่วยนะเพราะว่าทำน้ำอะไรดี
The way he comes towards this question of of right view is, he says, in the beginning, you know, all of us only understand it intellectually. We don't really understand it. We can't be he's not suggesting that we jump into it or come, you know, terms with it and all that. We don't know it yet. He's saying intellectually, just introduce the idea to the mind every time to help us to disengage a little. He said, at some point in our practice, sometimes it hits us what it is. But then it's real. Yeah.
Because I've been taking this beginning class, but have practiced in some other environments. But I've heard people come up with the experience, like a flash of some moment of feeling.
Yeah.
Sort of groundlessness,
yes.
Or you know, where am I while I'm practicing?
That's
and they're not sure how to sort of negotiate within that experience. It's possible to freak out. And
he says the sense of disbalance, or whatever you call it, comes from the fact that there's only a flash. And then out of that flash, you don't know what to do with it. So it's unsettling. So his advice is, try to get, like, experience that often, again and again. Then you get used to it. Yes, then it becomes nature. He says, once is not enough.
I'm hoping to choreograph the date. So
this is Steve Armstrong, by the way.
So Sayadaw has to have his meal before noon, so we're going to break for lunch now. And we'll take an hour and a half. We'll be back at 1. We've managed to use up the whole morning without much silence. But I have gotten a massive amount of instruction. So when we come back at 1, we'll sit for a while. And then this afternoon, there'll be opportunities. In the meantime, between now and then, you should be practicing also.
He says, you only sit here because you have nothing else to do.
So there'll be opportunities for further questions also. So there'll be opportunity for further questions, Stephanie. So please take the opportunity for the next hour and a half, while eating and going to the toilet and talking and walking and seeing the streets, to be mindfully aware. And when we come back, we'll try some of that in silence.
and then with further dialogue. Okay?
Oh, wait.
Now, wait just a second.
We're not ready to break it.
I'm not ready. You can go.
Okay.
I'll be along in a minute.